Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, Matty and I break out our Genesis and Gloria Gaynor LPs as we share our top five mid-decade movies.
Movies about the 70s, but not made in the 70s. Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, the second film in our Bergman marathon, The Seventh Seal, and music from Johnny Society.
But first, Russell Crowe stalks Denzel Washington in American Gangster.
The man I worked for had one of the biggest companies in New York City. He didn't own his own company. White man owned it, so they owned him. Nobody owns me, though. The most important thing in business is honesty.
Bribery? Extortion?
Integrity, hard work.
Murder? Racketeering?
Family. Never forgetting where we came from.
King Kong ain't got nothing on me. If I recall correctly, Matty, those were the first words out of your mouth as we exited American Gangster last week. Of course, referencing Denzel Washington's Oscar-winning turn as a corrupt cop in Training Day. In fairness to Washington, who is too great an actor to simply reprise a celebrated performance, his Frank Lucas, the real-life heroin kingpin who ran Harlem in the 70s, has none of Alonzo Harris's bluster and bravado. But in fairness to you, Matty, he is every bit as charismatic and arguably even more ruthless. In a three-way battle royale between Alonzo, Lucas, and King Kong, I might just put my money on the steely businessman Lucas. Now, much has been made, including here on Film Spotting, about the fact that American Gangster stars not one but two acting heavyweights. Washington's former virtuosity adversary Russell Crowe plays Richie Roberts, the cop determined to bring Lucas down. An article in the New Entertainment Weekly suggests that the success of this film will largely depend on how interested audiences are in watching two, quote, Oscar-winning powerhouses slug it out on screen. And Crowe himself notes that when he and Washington got in front of the cameras, everyone on the set was glued to the monitors waiting to watch the sparks fly. I know I couldn't wait to watch the sparks fly, Matty. There's only one problem. Crowe and Washington share the camera for all of about 5 minutes in this movie at the end of the film. Were their individual performances, then, enough to sustain your enjoyment of Ridley Scott's quasi-epic tale of capitalism, corruption, and social unrest?
No.
Okay.
I have to say, quite honestly, no. I think as a pure procedural good cop versus bad kingpin, this movie's fine. It operates on that level, and it reminds me a lot of Heat. You know, but that comparison says a lot in and of itself, because I don't find Heat all that transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
And how many scenes can you remember from Heat? And how many scenes can you really remember from this film?
You're asking the wrong person, because I can remember a lot of scenes from Heat. And actually, the comparison is good, though, because, of course, in Heat, De Niro and Pacino really are on screen together
right.
for only about
and
5 minutes.
The one scene that I can remember.
Uh-huh.
And this film here, I think, sort of suffers because it's indicative of where Ridley Scott is now today, in that he's all style, all gloss, very, very little substance. And you talk about the two different plot lines that go throughout this film. I love the Russell Crowe storyline. I was with it, and I think Crowe is absolutely fantastic in this film. But the Frank Lucas story and Denzel Washington's portrayal never worked for me, and it troubled me for a couple reasons. Number one, he never changes. Never. He's a monster from scene one, and he's a monster at the end. And every scene in between only serves to prove how tough he is.
Mm-hmm.
He's never actually challenged. And it really comes across to me as sort of posturing, cool posturing in polyester. Look how tough I can be. The scene that embodies this fullest for me is the scene in the diner where Frank Lucas is with his brothers and he excuses himself to go kill a rival in broad daylight. It was just silly. It was absolutely trivial and silly and didn't really... What did that show you about Frank Lucas, the man, other than that he's sort of a cookie-cutter embodiment of what's wrong with the American dream, sort of a black Tony Montana?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair, and in the few articles and reviews I've seen of this movie so far, everyone has mentioned Scarface. There is a little bit of that glorification factor, just as maybe De Palma does in that film. And it's interesting, you say how he never really changes. He doesn't actually change. The Washington portrayal of Frank Lucas doesn't change at all until the end of the film, until the scene with Crow
right.
at the end of the film. And by that point, it feels totally disingenuous.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he's got a smile on his face, and we're kind of supposed to like him. And I'm thinking, wait a second, where did this come from?
That was Denzel Washington being Denzel Washington.
You're right.
I really had a problem with that scene. Russell Crowe acts him under the table in that scene.
In that scene. And I do think, though, that Denzel is so naturally magnetic, though, that even though he is cookie cutter, and maybe we've seen it before, the fact is you are drawn to him, or at least I was.
And that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I think it does speak to the glorification that this movie has. I, after about 30 minutes into it, was hoping someone would come along and just shoot this guy.
Really?
I didn't want to spend any time with him, because the fact of the matter is, if we're supposed to believe really how big his franchise was, he's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of people and thousands of families. And that is really never spoken to, except for one 30-second pan across a couple flop rooms.
Yes.
And it never rings true. And it's so funny, because my family and I were having dinner the other night at one of the best restaurants in Chicago. And this woman walks by completely naked. She's not covering herself at all.
Seriously?
Seriously.
You were out for your mom's birthday,
right?
I was out for my
mom's birthday. She walks by the restaurant completely naked, and she's crying. She's not trying to hide herself at all. And you can see the track marks on her arm. That's the effect that this has on people. And I hated the depiction that they did of 1970s Harlem. It's too sterile. It's not gritty enough. It's Disney-esque in the way it comes across. And it's just sort of playing pageant. And if you're going to put that up there for me to digest, then you better be prepared for me to walk out absolutely disgusted.
Yeah, now I wasn't disgusted in the way that you were. I didn't have that kind of a visceral reaction to it. But I agree with you. I think part of the problem with this film is it's trying to be very gritty. And in fact, the look of it is even grainy, but it feels so synthetic and fake, like they're trying too hard.
Never hits
it. It's not nearly as gritty, for example, as even the movie we talked about last week, Gone Baby Gone,
exactly.
which feels authentically, you know, the way it's getting Dorchester. You believe that. You don't believe this for a second.
Well, you know, it's like it's playing dress up in the 1970s. You know how I know it's the 1970s? Because in every scene where there's a TV on, automatically
it's Nixon or it's
showing the fall of Saigon.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that you do make a great point. It didn't bother me, as I said, as much as you in terms of getting that kind of personal reaction to it. But a clear sign that I think Ridley Scott is doing something wrong here, something that rubbed me the wrong way, are those scenes that you mentioned. And the reason they rub me the wrong way isn't necessarily because I think he needs to show more about the ravages of drug abuse, but because it feels like lip service. There is the fact that he does show some of those scenes, and it was funny because I mentioned that Entertainment Weekly article, and when you read Russell Crowe in this interview, he says that Frank Lucas's life was glamorous, but he says, but Ridley also shows the damage Frank did. He shows young girls injecting heroin into their feet. He shows a mother passed out on the bed while her kid is crying. Frank's life may have had some glamour, but Frank's business caused and is shown to cause in the film a hell of a lot of damage.
No,
the fact
no,
is, he's wrong. He may have thought the film shows that, but those scenes were exactly the moments I was going to single out as problematic with this film, because it's almost as if Ridley Scott felt guilty about the fact that he was turning Frank Lucas into such a glamorous figure that he then had to show these brief little snippets of, you know, a baby crying in a house with a mother who's OD'd, and that kind of shock. We talk about directors and writers not earning moments. This movie never earns those moments.
And it doesn't earn that scene between Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington at the end, actually. I was with Russell Crowe's character. I actually liked a lot of his storyline. He's pretty much estranged from his family. And I think those scenes with his wife and his son really work. But there were some theatrical courtroom scenes that don't work. And those are the scenes that pop out throughout this film that are like, what is this serving? They're just too theatrical. They're too stagey. I'm thinking of the boxing match where Denzel Washington is wearing this chinchilla outfit. And that's the reason that the police pick up on him, you know. And it just, that whole scene just seems surreal in its staging and not to fit in. And I'm also thinking of the Amazing Grace scene, which is just so dripping and derivative, where you see him at church, and of course, Amazing
Feels
Grace.
Like The Godfather.
It's ridiculous.
You know,
how manipulative.
With all the loose ends being tied up, it does. It's there. The fact is, though, I didn't hate this film as much as you did. I actually think I can barely recommend it, just because I was enough interested in those two main characters. Mm-hmm. I think that Ridley Scott was trying to do something interesting in terms of setting up two really contradictory, hypocritical characters, and I thought they were complex enough to be interesting. Russell Crowe more so than Frank Lucas, but that idea of him being this honest cop and sort of turning himself into a martyr, he thinks he's a martyr in a way, when the fact is he's a really dishonest husband, and as much as he's a bulldog of a cop, mm-hmm. you know, he can't be bothered to spend any time with his kid, for example. And then Frank Lucas, on the other side, I thought it was interesting how he's a guy who reveres his mentor, Bumpy Johnson, the guy who ran Harlem before mm-hmm. him, and wants to do everything just like him. But the last lesson Bumpy gives him is that, you know, you shouldn't run business the way these big stores run business, where it's impersonal and they just take, you know, they make the product, the manufacturer, and they cut out the middleman. And they give it to the customers, and there's no customer service. That's exactly then what he goes and does to make a living off of this heroin by importing it himself from Southeast Asia.
Well, that's one of the opening scenes. And compare that scene, which I, again, think was too stagey and theatrical, to, like, say, Goodfellas. All Goodfellas has to say is Big Polly didn't use telephones. Mm-hmm. Big Polly didn't have to move for anybody. Here we get this really clunky dialogue at the beginning setting up how he's going to cut out the middleman from his mentor Bumpy Johnson. Mm-hmm. Just another scene again that didn't work, but you know, one thing that I liked and I wish that Ridley Scott had shown more of it was the scenes with Ruby Dee playing his mother.
Yes.
You can tell, especially the one scene I'm thinking about towards the end of the film, you can tell she's off script in that film, just trying to get her son's attention. And in that scene, you actually see Denzel Washington have to react to her.
You're right.
And it's the first time you see him without putting on this Oscar performance bravura.
Sure. And the problem then with that scene, though, is it ends really abruptly,
yep.
and it adds up to nothing. It plays no factor in the rest of the film at all, and we're just left to sort of assume, well,
because
I
we
guess
get
he
to
listened
the
to his mother.
Yep,
yeah,
exactly.
You know, it doesn't make any sense. And there are a lot of scenes like that. There's a scene just like that where he's sitting with his little nephew, I guess, or whatever, and he says, I want to be just like you. And it's sort of one of those scenes that you expect to see in a movie mm-hmm. like this, but then it goes nowhere. It plays no role in the rest of the film. There are a lot of moments like that. And getting back to that idea, too, of it not really feeling gritty enough or authentic, for all the ground this movie tries to cover, I mentioned the politics of it, and Vietnam is here, yeah. and social progress, racism, it's all there, and yet it was 2 hours and 37 minutes long, and I guess to its credit, it never felt that long to
me.
Oh,
it did to me.
It didn't to me, but to its detriment, I was surprised it was that long, only because for all the ground it covers, I felt like it just skimmed the surface of all those things. Kind of in the way we talk about biopics, mm-hmm. just sort of feeling inevitable at a certain point. They're just going to give us the scenes we expect. That's exactly what you get out of this film.
Another example of that is Josh Brolin, who basically plays the corrupt cop.
Yeah.
And he just sort of flits in and out of this movie. And
he does.
I think he's supposed to represent all these corrupt cops.
Sure.
Which, come on, this movie isn't Serpico. That movie does it better, but at least do it some service.
Yeah, and that is a problem I noted as well. Josh Brolin, who's going to be on the show next mm-hmm. week, and he's getting
to
be in this prestigious movie. He's very good, but he's in a really one-note role
yeah.
as this Detective Truppo, who is sort of the embodiment of police corruption. And unfortunately, he's one of those people, like a lot of people in this film, a lot of interesting character actors who get nothing to do.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Nicky Barnes.
Yeah, who I actually liked in this film.
See, I found him distracting, but that plot line doesn't go anywhere.
No, it doesn't go anywhere. A lot doesn't go anywhere. We agree with that. But I was so shocked about the fact that you're watching Cuba Gooding Jr., who, ever since he won for Jerry Maguire, mm-hmm. has basically played variations on that mm-hmm. and always had to showboat and get attention. Here he's playing a Harlem pimp, a flamboyant Harlem drug lord, and he's actually subdued. I actually thought he was restrained. I couldn't believe that there was subtlety in his performance, and I liked it. But I'm thinking more of some of these other people who we don't really know their names or faces, the kind of that guys, the people that Richie, Russell Crowe's character, recruits for his team.
Yeah, good
John
point.
Hawks.
Good point.
And RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. Some really interesting faces and some really interesting characters, I think they would be, and yet they get nothing to do. I also really like John Ortiz, who played his partner, who is a junkie. He is really good, but again, he's only here for a little bit of time. It doesn't get much to do. So there's just a lot going on, and it really doesn't add up to a whole lot, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, I completely forgot about Ortiz in this movie because I think it's just so sprawling.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to cover so much ground, and he does it with such a cursory lens that none of it really ever lands. All that said, though, I have to say, as a cop versus bad guy movie,
it works.
It works.
It does sort of work. And I will say, too, my last comment, a little bit of praise for it. I think the last shot of the film, which I will not get into, but the last sequence I actually think is really brilliant. Mm-hmm. A really subtle moment that allows the audience to have to use our imagination and says everything we needed to say just in terms of the soundtrack and the final shot without Ridley Scott hitting us over the head with it. It's a great moment, but it's the best moment in the film, maybe, and it's at the end. So yeah. American Gangster is in theaters now. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
All right, time for a quick break. And as for first movies directed by actors, all I have to say is Shadows, John Cassavetes, for shame, boys. Listener feedback is next. Please stay with us. I heard you say it's okay, love, give it all away. The love I need, the life I need, the songs I feel, what's keeping me alive. I heard you say
hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hey, Film Spotting guys. My name is Wally. I'm in Los Angeles, driving along in the dreadful, dreadful traffic and listening to your podcast about musicians turned actors, and I couldn't help but notice the omission of a certain Harry Connick Jr. Yes, the crooner from New Orleans who gave a magnificent voice performance in The Iron Giant. Really, really good stuff on his end. Also very good in stuff like Independence Day and EGAD. I'm going to say it, Hope Floats.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. A nice voicemail there from Wally with love for Harry Connick Jr. Maddie, do you have a favorite Harry Connick performance?
Oh, I love him in Will and Grace mm-hmm. and Memphis Belle and any other movie he dies in. Wait, no, he doesn't die in Memphis Belle.
No, he doesn't.
But I think he dies pretty early on in Independence Day.
Yeah, he might. And he also is very good, actually, in the movie Bug, the William Friedkin film earlier this year. He's got a small role there as a thuggish,
I think we're agreeing small roles might
Yeah,
Harry
maybe
Connick
small
Jr.
roles.
Best.
He really hasn't had any big roles other than Copycat, which I can't say I have a lot of love for. But no. Wally, we do appreciate the voicemail, and we will get into some more listener feedback here in a moment. But we did want to take a moment to get into our poll questions. And also, I wanted to apologize, Maddie, to our friend, maybe I hope someday, our friend Paul Thomas Anderson. I mentioned last week on the show, I believe, that There Will Be Blood, I thought it had been pushed back from December to January.
Right.
It turns out, as one listener pointed out, I was wrong. What I was thinking of, it's just been pushed back to a January release here in Chicago.
Oh.
But it is opening before the first of the year in New York
so
and L.A.
So they are getting it in for the Oscars.
Getting it in for the Oscars. So that film, There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis, which we are highly anticipating coming out this year. My apologies for worrying all the P.T. Anderson fans out there. With that, let's get to our poll questions. And Maddie, let's start with last week's poll question. We asked about Ben Affleck tying in with his directorial debut in Gone Baby Gone. And we wanted to know what listeners thought Ben Affleck's best performance to date was. And the choices were Chucky in Good Will Hunting, George Reeves in Hollywoodland, Holden in Chasing Amy, or O'Banion in Dazed and Confused. And of course, you could also choose other. How did it come out?
Well, I was a little bit surprised by that. Number one, Holden in Chasing Amy with 34%. Number two, Chucky, Good Will Hunting at 28%. Number three, O'Banion in Dazed and Confused, 20%. At number four, George Reeves in Hollywoodland at 10%. And other close behind at 8%. I thought Hollywoodland would get more love.
Did you?
Yeah.
Even though I didn't really think a lot of people probably saw that, but he was very good in that film. And I went with Holden in Chasing Amy, and Maddie, you went with O'Banion, if
oh,
I remember.
I love O'Banion.
Yeah,
can't
he
get
is great. Him. Next week on the show, we're reviewing the Coen Brothers' new film, No Country for Old Men. So we want to know what you think the best Coen Brothers film is. What is your favorite Coen Brothers movie?
And the choices are The Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Fargo, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, or Raising Arizona. Adam, where would you fall in there?
Can I change my vote after next week's show?
Yeah.
Okay, well, for now, I would probably go with, this is so hard because I really, really like every single movie there. Yeah. I probably have to say my favorite film from this list is Fargo.
Yeah, I think it's probably the best. Although, you know, when I took this job, I promised myself I just would not talk about The Big Lebowski mm-hmm. that much. And I thought I'd been, you know, pretty good so far. I think Lebowski would probably be my number one because I'm just thinking of movies I've watched over and over again. Lebowski, I always cue it up.
And I think Lebowski is probably going to win, but we do want to see for sure. Yeah. So please go over to filmspotting.net, vote in the poll, make your voice heard on the Coen brothers. Let's now jump into the mailbag a little bit here. Maddie, we got some Gone Baby Gone feedback, speaking of Ben Affleck, in response to our review last week. And I thought this one was an interesting thought here. We've got some kind of contradictory reactions here going on. Let's start with this one from Josh Ratty here in Chicago.
He says, "Hey, Adam and Matt, I agreed with most of your Gone Baby Gone review, though. I thought the big drawback to the film was Ben Affleck's direction. Yes, he got the community aspect correct and the overall mood is right, but he made some very poor choices as far as character development. For instance, you guys praised Amy Ryan, and she is terrific, but how do we meet her? She's obviously trashy, right? So, of course, she's watching Jerry Springer and leaving half-eaten snacks on her coffee-slash-cocaine table. Or when we meet a drug dealer early in the film, one of the first shots is a close-up of him lighting a doobie. These are such obvious cliché choices that make me think Affleck just doesn't know the characters and doesn't know how to be subtle about their development. Ben Affleck plus directorial debuts plus forced character development equals Crash minus Paul Haggis." Ouch.
Ouch, Josh. Okay, well put there. But in rebuttal to that, we have Michael Bell. And I will say we're only going to read a snippet here of Michael's response, but he completely disagrees with Josh. He says, "As Adam suggested, Affleck's partisanship in this class war is clear. His camera isn't just effective in catching the grotesque, it's also effective at capturing and visually deriding class markers. Jerry Springer on the TV in the background of the mother's apartment comes to mind as one of the several examples." And Michael does go into some detail about how he thinks Affleck is using television in particular, but he obviously sees that as not a cliched choice at all, but really an intentional choice on Affleck's part to impart some kind of commentary. And he says, "My ultimate point is that Affleck maintains impressive control of unwieldy material throughout the movie. This is masterful, confident filmmaking and one of the best movies of the year," Michael says.
Very nice.
So I did want to bring this up, though, only because it was interesting. One of our listeners who actually hails from Dorchester, Jared Medeiros, wrote in and he sent me a link to a Slate article about Ben Affleck's Boston. And he says in it something really interesting, this writer who grew up in the area, that does support what I said on the show, that I thought maybe Affleck went a little too far in trying to show that he was an insider and he actually ended up coming off as an outsider. And I love it when I'm not crazy, because according to this writer, he says, "In striving to capture Boston in all its sordid glory, Affleck over-applies the grit. The problem struck me in an early scene in which the camera lingers on a gaggle of daytime boozers, and I swear more than one of them has a cleft lip. In an effort to cast aside the Hollywood airbrush, Affleck has zoomed in on the freakish underbelly of Boston and somewhat overstated the case." So I'm just glad to know that I was watching the film and not totally insane, that his camera did seem to linger a little too long and maybe emphasize the grotesque, the circus-like aspect of Dorchester that probably isn't really accurate.
Yeah, well, I guess, and if you look at our review of American Gangster, I like the grit. I'm not going to hold what Ben Affleck shows me against the whole Southie neighborhoods of Boston. I can actually make that distinction, and I really did like the grotesque and the depravity that he showed us.
Well, I would obviously not agree with that. There comes a point where it becomes too much, and like I said, he becomes one of those people that I think the people there in Dorchester we see in the film who look at, like, Angie and Patrick and think they're not one of them, they would look at Ben Affleck that way and wonder, why are you focusing on only the worst, you know? Yeah. So anyway, some interesting thoughts there about Gone Baby Gone. It is a film we do recommend checking out. But let's get to some more feedback on our top five from last week, Maddie. And that was actors turned directors. Obviously, Ben Affleck, one of those people here. And we focused specifically on debuts.
Michael Bell, our friend Michael Bell, again, writes in and says, "All I have to say is Shadows, John Cassavetes, for shame, boys."
And Josiah Johnson here is with Michael Bell. Let's start with his number five, though. Sofia Coppola in The Virgin Suicides. Number four, Warren Beatty in Reds. And I thought he was cheating here.
I know,
but he says he actually co-directed Heaven Can Wait with Buck Henry, but this was Beatty's proper debut as a solo artist, maybe.
No, would have been number one on my list, so of course it doesn't count.
It would have been in my top five as well. You're right. So I didn't know about that little exemption due to the Buck Henry rule.
Is that Buck Henry from Saturday Night Live?
I believe so, but I actually do not know for sure. Number three, Liv Ullmann, the Bergman actress for Sophie. Number two, Laurence Olivier's Henry V, not to diminish the Branagh version, which I think was number two on my list, but this was the single greatest Shakespeare adaptation ever put to celluloid. Those are some bold words there. I'm not sure I buy that, Josiah. But then his number one, John Cassavetes' Shadows. There would be no American independent film movement, and certainly no Buffalo 66, which was on my list, if not for Shadows Cassavetes launched a new style of screen acting with this film by famously subverting the Stanislavski method in order to create an urban microdrama utterly devoid of pretense. I agree, it's a great choice. I did want to include some Cassavetes, but as I wrote back to Michael Bell, actually, I said, really? I mean, Shadows as a film that you really love, I've seen it, and I do like many Cassavetes films, but Shadows to me is one of those noble experiments. It's Cassavetes really trying to figure out what he wants his style to be and how he wants to make films. I love it as an experiment, as a film, just to enjoy, maybe not. But obviously, some of our listeners here, Maddie, do really appreciate Shadows.
I've never seen it.
Okay. Let's move on then to this one, Ivar in Norway.
Oh, Ivar Knudsen. Hi, Adam and Maddie. I loved your top five this week, and I made my own top five. George Clooney, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, surprisingly well-made from the sexiest man alive. Robert De Niro, A Bronx Tale, solid debut. It shows that he has worked with many talented directors. Number three, Sean Penn, The Indian Runner. I like everything he has done as a director, and this might be his best. Once again, John Cassavetes for Shadows. Great debut from the father of independent cinema. And number one, now this is a touchy one between Adam and I, is John Huston in The Maltese Falcon. He didn't have many movie roles before he directed, but he was originally a stage actor, so I'll consider him eligible. Yes, I can hear you protesting now.
Maddie, are you going to protest that inclusion of John Huston?
Well, yes and no, a little bit, because I included Paul Mazursky. A lot of people would not know him as an actor. I didn't know John Huston actually was an actor, first and foremost. So technically, yeah, I think he goes on the list. But you were pretty vehement. You weren't going to include him.
I wasn't going to. And actually, I do have to apologize in a way that we're even getting these emails. And we got others saying, how could you overlook The Maltese Falcon and John Huston? Because I had it in my notes for my top five that we were supposed to mention right off the top that we excluded John Huston.
Right.
Because we did try to use that criterion that if they weren't known as an actor, really known as an actor, then that didn't really work. Same thing with the musicians list from a few weeks ago. You had to actually know them as a musician. John Huston was in bit parts, uncredited roles. I don't know that you could really have considered him a known commodity as an actor before he made The Maltese Falcon. But technically, yes, absolutely, he does count. Just as you pointed out, and I told you we had to exclude him, Sidney Lumet started as an actor as well before he made 12 Angry Men. So technically, Sidney Lumet counts as well. But did anyone really think of him as, oh, that actor, Sidney Lumet? I don't know, but I'm guessing not. But again, absolutely, we heard everyone that wanted to make note of John Huston. And that brings us, Maddie, to the last one here we want to share. You had Dances with Wolves as your number five, and you said you can hear the listeners protesting now. I didn't think you'd get much complaint. Josh Stubbs writes in and says he, for one, will certainly complain about the choice of Dances with Wolves. Kevin Costner completely wimps out and makes an asinine, condescending film. He smugly spends the whole movie setting up how welcoming and peaceful the Sioux are and how much more rewarding and free his life is in their culture. Oh yeah, Costner and screenwriter Blake sure spend a lot of time telling the audience how great the Sioux are, but not so great that, God forbid, he should ever enter into an interracial relationship with one of them. When it comes time for Costner to develop a romantic storyline, he conveniently produces Mary McDonnell as a white character living among the tribe, and he recommends we check out something like the Canadian film Dance Me Outside by Bruce McDonald instead of Dances with Wolves. Do you want to take on Josh Stubbs, Maddie?
No, I think it's a really well-articulated point. And one that when I first saw it, of course, I didn't even think about it because when this movie first came out, it took so many hits for being so overtly leftist in its views of the Sioux. I mean, it basically puts the kid gloves on their treatment. There's no redeeming white people in the film outside of Kevin Costner. Mm-hmm. But I had never thought of that before. It is really an escape clause, so Kevin Costner really doesn't have to deal with the complexities of the interracial relationship.
Well, as always, we appreciate all the great feedback. And if you do have any other feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and a friendly game of chess with the Grim Reaper. Stay with us.
Nothing comes for free, boys. Your nightmare's on a seesaw.
It's time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, and there are definitely some exciting releases. One of the new releases coming out, Ratatouille, the Pixar film from Brad Bird that, if I remember correctly, Sam really loved and I just liked here on the show, but definitely worth checking out.
I was actually kind of, I think I left this film.
Really?
I had other things to do. I mean, I thought it was fine, but I wasn't that engrossed by it.
Okay. Well, Ratatouille is out now. I know many of our listeners did love that movie. Also, speaking of great 70s movies we're talking about here on
this
show.
About this one.
The special collector's edition of Chinatown, one of my Pantheon films, contains a lot of extras, including interviews from Polanski and Robert Towne and the producer Robert Evans. So special edition of Chinatown, definitely on my Christmas list.
Well, Robert Evans, that's got to be worth it.
Just it's
got to
be worth it right there. You're absolutely right.
Right there.
Also a movie reviewed here on Film Spotting. Sicko, the Michael Moore documentary, is out, including 7 never-before-seen segments, which adds 45 minutes of footage. And also, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. The Kevin James and Adam Sandler movie is out. And then, the Coen Brothers gift set.
Whoa.
5 films from the Coen Brothers: Fargo, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Raising Arizona, and Blood Simple. I think all 5 of those were just in our poll question. Maddie, we asked about your favorite Coen Brothers movie. All 5 are great films, and another one that should be added to our Christmas list.
Exactly.
Okay, so check those movies out now, coming out Tuesday. Before we get to donations, Maddie, I did want to just briefly give a shout-out to our friend Sean out in Seattle, who is doing another series at his Landmark Theater, which he is the manager of. And this one was actually a little bit inspired by the show. They're doing 3 weeks of movies from 3 different great directors based on a comparison we made between Terrence Malick's The New World and Werner Herzog. So, again, 9 films here, it looks like. They've got 3 Herzog films and then 3 Terrence Malick films, including Days of Heaven and The New World, and then 3 Howard Hawks movies. So if you're out in the Seattle area, sounds like a great series to check out. So we'll put a link with more information in the notes for this show on filmspotting.net.
Wow, sounds great.
Mm-hmm. So let's now get to donations. We definitely want to thank some people who were so generous last week as to go to the PayPal link on the filmspotting.net site and throw us a few bucks.
Yeah, thank you, thank you, thank you to Benjamin Crazy Sexy Sly, a Silver Club member, John Hooked on Phoenix, Leopoldo Reconsidering Retirement, I Want My Records Back, Brett, Barbecue Sauce.
Yes, I believe that's actually Reconsidering Retirement / I Want My Records Back, and then Barbecue Sauce. This is Sam's stream of consciousness. If you knew Leopoldo's last name, let's just say it references a famous football player, it would actually make sense. So
Sam's getting some good stuff up there in Milwaukee.
He is, definitely. We appreciate all of your donations. Thanks to everyone who generously donated this week.
You know how I said I shot 5 men? It weren't true. That Mexican had come at me with a knife. I just busted his leg with a shovel. I didn't kill him or nothing either.
Well, you sure killed the hell out of that fella today.
Hell yeah. Killed the hell out of him, didn't I?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part where Adam and I massacre a film we love, and you, our beloved listeners, get a shot at a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred Unforgiven, a tie-in with our top 5 actors turned directors. Of course, Clint Eastwood directing that one.
Yes, not a debut film, but a great film from a great actor turned director. And we did get a lot of entries last week. Apparently, it was a very easy selection. Of course, I blame that on you, Maddie, ever the prima donna actor. I gave you the direction not to say the name Will in your opening line. You did it anyway. You never listened to direction.
You were so caught up. Usually what happens is we go back and we re-record, but you were just so caught up. You knew you can't mess with an actor.
That's absolutely
right. When he's so in the zone.
You were in a zone. I didn't want to mess with it. A lot of congratulations on your great performance this week, Maddie. It was very good. Some people even suggesting that maybe we need to change the name of the segment because you weren't massacring it.
All right. I'll try my hardest to be worse.
Okay. Well, I bet you can do it this week, which we will get to in a moment. But first, the winner.
Yes, Adam, please, drum roll, please reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Robert Cortez from Houston, Texas. Congratulations, Robert. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and if you thought last week's entry was easy, this one is maybe going to be the easiest one ever. We realize that, Maddie. In fact, I tried to dissuade you from using this scene, but then we realized that it actually could be perfect, because not only is it funny, and not only does it tie in with our theme this week, top 5 movies about the 70s, but it also allows us to give a little bit of a shout-out to all of our listeners out in the SoCal area dealing with these wildfires.
Right.
I had a chance to meet some of these people, our San Diego listeners. back during a San Diego meetup earlier this summer, and I definitely have had them in my thoughts. We have both had our listeners in our thoughts these past couple of weeks, and so wanted to use this scene as a way to pay tribute to them. So, Maddie, you started off. I'm going to give you the action, and action.
San Diego. Drink it in. It always goes down smooth.
What a beautiful view, Mr. Blank.
I know. I love this city. It's a fact. It's the greatest city in the history of mankind. Discovered by the Germans in 1904, they named it San Diego, which of course in German means a whale's vagina.
No, there's no way that's correct.
I'm sorry. I was trying to impress you.
Oh.
I don't know what it means, I'll be honest. I don't think anyone knows what it means anymore. Scholars maintain that the translation was lost hundreds of years ago.
Doesn't it mean Saint Diego?
No. No.
No, that's what it means, really.
Well, agree to disagree.
And scene.
Now, if you know what film Adam and I just massacred, and I can't believe you don't, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. By Wednesday, November 7th, the winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit www.filmspotting.net.
A bit of music there, Maddie, from the opening scenes of Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. I think we should just play that music at the start of every show, set the tone for a nice dramatic, heavy
Make
show.
Make every show epic.
There you go.
Well, Mr. Kempinar, I mean, it's sort of become in vogue for cinephiles to distance themselves from Bergman's Seventh Seal. And in watching it, you really can't help but be struck by the extremism of this movie. It's not an exercise in nuance. It's an overt existential question in the form of a parable. A knight, Antonius Block, returns to his Swedish homeland after the Crusades to find it overrun with the plague, and begins, of course, with the famous chess scene between the pale-faced Igor Cloak Death and Max von Sydow's Aryan Knight. Now, Death has always been at the knight's side, he says, but the knight brokers a deal to let the outcome of their chess game, which will continue throughout the film, determine his fate. And so he sets off across the countryside to reunite with his wife, and he and his squire encounter various characters, witch burnings, penitent lashings, and a humble acting troupe, which includes the couple Mary and Joseph, and their young son, of course named Michael. Adam, this movie has been parodied time and time again, most famously in our generation, I think brilliantly, by Bill and Ted and their excellent adventures. Does The Seventh Seal hold up as the groundbreaking masterpiece it was originally hailed as, or has time proven a none-too-kind mistress to Bergman's Death as Kasparov motif?
Well, I can't speak for how groundbreaking it may have been at the time, and the film might meander a bit too much for me to say it's my favorite Bergman film. I want to stick with that chess game, or at least stick with Antonius Block. I think he's the most interesting character, mm-hmm. and obviously set up as our protagonist. And Bergman really does introduce us to a lot of characters here, and I do see how they fit into the grand narrative, but I can't help but not really care too much about the Smith, for example,
yeah.
and his strumpet of a wife who runs off with one of the traveling actors. There are
that's the
a
one,
lot of diversions.
That's the one diversion that really doesn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work for me at all, but Bergman here has not only given us some of the most indelible images in cinema, the first shot of Death, of course, on the beach, the first shot of the knight and Death sitting down to the chess game with the waves crashing in the background, and then, of course, the great end of the film, the Dance of Death mm-hmm. up the hillside, among many other great shots in the film. But he's able to weave together these really serious philosophical and intellectual questions, and you mentioned rightly this existential quest the knight is on, but also there are these clearly very personal questions that Bergman is dealing with that are nevertheless universal. But he mixes that all together with this absurdity and humor, I think, in a way that filmmakers can. This is a very funny movie at times.
It's funny because that is the number one note that I have. I have seen this film before. I must have been in high school. I didn't remember how funny this film was, and not just the overt comic pieces, right, you know, the comic troupe, but Max von Sydow's Knight. He realizes how absurd this thing is. Yes, he questions God a lot, and there's just, I love that confessional scene. I think we'll touch on that in a little bit. But at the same time, he realizes how absurd it is that he is playing a continuous chess game with death, and Gunnar Bjornstad as the squire is hilarious.
Yes.
And I just love what that evokes in me, in that, how do you deal with life? You're not going to beat death at chess, okay? So it asks, how do you deal with life? And, you know, you can be melancholic about it, you can be hysterical about it, or you can laugh at it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it you have to combine all three to be happiest.
No, I think you're exactly right. That's a great point. And it is funny, I had seen this film back in college, and I forgot, just as you had, how funny it was. That was one thing that didn't stick with me at all. And here you really notice it. And it is funny because we think about Bergman being so serious all the time, so weighty. And we did start this marathon with a comedy, Smiles of a Summer Night, which was very funny. And surely you're not going to get many laughs in some of his later films, or films like Persona and Cries and Whispers and Scenes from a Marriage. But here, my favorite scene was the one where death comes for the actor, the one who had stolen away the Smith's wife, and he climbs up into a tree, and he's kind of patting himself on the back for pulling off this scene, convincing him that he was dead, and he's just talking to himself and waiting up there, thinking about how long he'll have to wait, and then all of a sudden there's this sawing sound coming from down below, and it's death cutting the tree down. And there's something so fantastically absurd and funny about that moment of death in this black robe with the white face sawing down the tree, saying, you know what, you're next.
Yeah, I couldn't get over how much a real life character death really is in this film. This guy is so cool. I honest to God think he could be in like Ocean's 11 or something like that. You know, give him Bernie Mac's role or something like
right.
that. But he's just so cool. And it's funny because when this film opened, and of course you've got the Bergman opening, you've got the melodramatic score, you've got the close-up of a rock and the chess game on top of that rock,
yeah.
and the waves crashing, and then, you know, quick pans over to something else, and then you see death, and you're in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, this is art house parody. This is what we've been critiquing for so long. But the second that death opens his mouth, it moves it from that silent movie art house to a more grounding in reality. And yes, this is a surreal movie that asks a lot of existential questions. I mean, this is not a realistic drama, but it's Bergman's ability to combine the two, the surreal with something that we can relate to so that we can all go on this journey with him.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I do think that in addition to all those things you mentioned and the seriousness and the humor that we still find there, that absurdity, he still manages to have many moments that are legitimately scary, I think, or at least moments that will make you shift a little bit in your seat. There's an amazing sequence, the flagellants on parade, the people who are out there saying, you know what, we're being punished by the plague for our sins and you should all repent. That's a really frightening sequence, and you can kind of see how people feel compelled to bow down to that and say, oh yes, you know what, it must be our fault that something is going wrong here and we deserve to be punished.
Well, and it speaks to the other big thing I was struck with, was how relevant this film is to today's.
It is.
And
all
how
the stuff about fear.
All the stuff about fear. And here it's the church, but it could be any institution, especially now in post 9/11, you know, America.
Yeah.
Institutions can prey on our fear.
Yeah.
And I just love that. I just love that notion of how he gets at that. And it's timeless.
Yeah, it is. And the fact that he does it in a really subtle way. It
doesn't
feel as though he's trying to make this
much more subtle
really,
than Rendition,
for
a movie
example,
we reviewed last week.
You're absolutely right. It doesn't feel like he's trying to hit you over the head with that message, but it's absolutely there. And it is a timeless message, I think, as you said. But there's also a great moment where Antonius Block, the knight, is talking to the witch who's about to be burned by the soldiers. And he's asking her about the devil because he's trying to get answers about God. It's a great sequence. And she says something like, isn't that him right behind you? And I was just as scared as Block was in that moment that the devil might have been standing in some form right behind him. And it's all about the cut and the camera angle to the shot that's right behind Block with the witch in the background, and his head turns quickly. And just in that moment, seriously, I almost jumped a little bit on the couch watching this because I thought, wow, the devil is going to be behind him. What's the devil going to look like? It's that effective of a scene. And I also just like this idea the movie explores, where you realize as the movie goes on that Antonius Block isn't really buying time, I think, to avoid death. just because he wants to survive, which I think we would all want to. I think he's actually maybe a little bit ready to die. He makes it clear after fighting in the Crusades, he's tired and worn out.
Yeah, I never got that. And I read a couple things online, too, where they say that the knight is trying to buy time.
Right.
I never bought that.
Well,
death has been at his side throughout the Crusades.
Yeah.
He seems so calm with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's just trying to figure out, how exactly do I face death?
That's exactly right. He's not buying time just because he wants to live. He's buying time because he wants more answers. He's going to use this opportunity as a chance to finally get to the heart of, why is God absent? Why is God silent?
And that confessional scene is just absolutely beautiful. He says, where is God? Why won't God show his face? And terrifying to me, when death just sort of calmly wants to know the answer too.
Yeah.
And he's asking and questioning his faith.
Sure. And we get at the end that death even says, there is only death. That's the only certainty. Death doesn't have any answers. And what the movie says, what Bergman puts forth in this kind of humanism, I guess, is that despite God's unwillingness to show himself, to give you clear answers, that life is still worth living, that there are still those great moments that make it all worthwhile. You talked about the humor and finding the absurdity in life. And it's like those great moments in this film, eating the wild strawberries and drinking the milk with friends, that's what's going to provide solace in despair, not God. So it's pretty bleak, and yet at the same time, there's something uplifting about it, and that's why this film, I think, deserves to be considered a masterpiece.
Still relevant today.
Okay, well, Wild Strawberries, speaking of Wild Strawberries, that will be the next film in our Bergman Marathon, and if I remember correctly, talk about a great year, 1957.
Both films
came out at the same time, roughly. We will plan to discuss it in next week's show. As always, stay tuned to the calendar page at filmspotting.net for schedule updates.
Time for one last quick break. When we come back, Adam and I dust off our pet rocks and our polyester jumpsuits. Our top five movies about the 70s not made in the 70s. Stay with us.
Going to the place again where no one can reach me. No one can reach me. Going to the place again where no one can reach me. No one can reach me. I'm not gonna stand for the reign of mediocrity, breeding insincerity. So I'll just hold you down and we'll wait until it's over. Wait until it's over.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
You got the touch! You got the power!
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. One of the all-time great clips in cinema history there.
Got the touch!
From Boogie Nights. We had to play that. We wanted to play it a couple weeks ago when we had it for Massacre Theater, but we didn't play it, even though that clip is obviously from the 80s portion of Boogie Nights.
Right, exactly.
In case the keyboards didn't give it away.
From a movie, actually, Orson Welles' last film. Do you know the movie?
No.
Transformers, the animated version.
That song is in there?
I think so.
I think you're crazy.
All right. I think I'm right.
Okay.
I think I'm right. $5.
I just assumed that was
$5.
A made-up Paul Thomas Anderson song.
No.
Okay.
I swear to God, it's got to be. It's got to be.
Okay, man.
All right, man.
You're on.
All right.
Well, we played that because, obviously, the film Boogie Nights does take place, a big chunk of it, in the 1970s. It's a film I have a feeling will come up on a lot of listeners' lists in response to our top five list. But this does tie in with American Gangster, this concept of the me decade of the 70s. And Boogie Nights, we play that clip because it is not going to make either of our lists. I have a very specific reason why it won't make mine. We'll see maybe why it won't make your list here as we get into it. Maddie, what's your number five movie set in the 70s?
Well, my number five, actually, I sort of surprised myself with this pick, and that's Munich. I don't actually love this film, but I do remember when I was watching it, I was struck at how authentic the set design and production were. Every set, every interior looked authentic. And I have to admit, I really wanted Eric Bana's wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
So
That's as good a reason as any to make your list, I think, there, Maddie. Well, the me decade, I think you think of this idea of the hedonism of the 70s.
Oh, yes.
Drugs,
Bureau
and sex.
Agnew and,
yes, exactly. But Studio 54, stuff like that in the 70s. And I tried to think of those films that captured that essence of the decade. But what I found was there was this subsection of movies that really dealt with these characters who were on kind of these very personal quests that ended up being obsessive and maybe even a little bit destructive, actually tying in with American Gangster, tying in with not Frank Lucas, but the Richie Roberts character, the cop, on this quest to bring down Frank Lucas. So that's what I went for, and I'm not going to mention the hedonism movies I left off because they may come up on your list. I'll save them for the end of the segment, but my number five is, yours was a surprise for you, mine's a little bit of a surprise for me, it's The Hoax, the Lassie Hallström film that came out this year with Richard Gere, and this is a case where you've got, based on a true story of Clifford Irving, who schemed to publish the autobiography of Howard Hughes in the 70s, and it was a total sham, but he managed to convince McGraw-Hill that it was all legit, that Hughes had selected him, and he got a pretty huge payout for it. And as all of the lies start to unravel near the end, I do think the movie unravels a little bit, but Gere is great, and the depth of his lies and the way he manages to pull them off is really fascinating, and it gets into this me-decade aspect, I think, of he's a writer who believes that it's his time to be famous. He should get the credit that he has always deserved in his mind. He should be rich and popular and a best-selling writer, and he'll stop at nothing to achieve that, despite the damage it causes and the toll it takes on his friendships and his marriage and everything else. So The Hoax, again, not a perfect film, maybe by the end of it, but I do love Richard Gere in it, and it's a film worth checking out, my number five.
Well, it's in my queue because I do love me some Richard Gere.
Okay.
Now, my number four is a pretty obvious one. I think my whole list is pretty obvious because there weren't a lot of choices.
No, there weren't.
We kind of discussed this earlier. My number four is Dazed and Confused. I really think this is, you know, the American Graffiti for the 70s, and for me, what keeps drawing me back to it is the performances. I mean, every single person is on their A game. And every single time I watch it, I watch an actor that I hadn't really noticed before. I'm struck by how good they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like Marissa Ribisi is fantastic in this film. And so that's why I watch this film all the time. I just love it, Dazed and Confused.
And who does Marissa Ribisi even
play?
I don't recognize
her. She plays the redheaded nerd girl. So she hangs out with Tony Rapp and Adam mm-hmm. Goldberg. And of course, you know, the success of this movie is you identify the clique you would definitely belong to, and that would be me. And I think she's gorgeous in it.
Yeah, she really is. I know who you're talking about now, and I will pay attention to her performance the next time around.
Please
do,
Adam. Please do.
I will. My number four, again, keeping with this quest idea, Todd Haynes' 1995 film Velvet Goldmine, and this explores the glam rock era of the early 70s. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, as a David Bowie stand-in named Brian Slade, creates this Ziggy Stardust-like character named Maxwell Demon. And the quest here, in Citizen Kane fashion, you have Christian Bale as a journalist who is assigned to do a Where Are They Now type feature on him, a lot like his film that is coming out later this year, later this month, actually, I'm Not There, the Dylan biopic. This movie's kind of all over the place, kind of brilliant at times.
I can't
stand
this film.
Convoluted.
I really can't stand this film.
Well, I like it. It's not a personal favorite. I don't love this movie, but I do think it perfectly fits the topic and certainly captures, this is one film that does capture the personal quest motif I was going for, as well as the hedonism of the 70s. I do love, as Iggy Pop here, Ewan McGregor. I
yes,
think he's really
yeah,
great
he's,
as an American rocker. So, but again, it's all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's the 70s on screen, really, in that glam rock era. I think he gets it just right, as well as some great music in the film as well.
All right, well, my number three, kind of a cheat, I guess. It's When We Were Kings, and of course, it's a documentary.
Yeah, so it is a cheat.
It's vintage 1970s, but when you think about it, how uniting is that fight? I mean, that's an event that will never, ever happen again in this day and age with so many different things dividing our attention. And I think that's what I love about it. And you're never going to find a better showman, a better actor than Muhammad Ali in that film, and George Foreman as well. It's riveting.
Yeah, it is a great documentary. I did choose to leave off documentaries, but I absolutely understand its inclusion here. My number three, it was your number five, actually. I have Munich as well. I never thought that this would appear on both of our lists, but I think it's one of Spielberg's best films, and it fits in perfectly here because it's kind of the anti-hedonism film. You talk about the me decade and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Here, Eric Bana's character, Avner, isn't interested in any of those things, but he is on this obsessive quest for justice, completing his mission of bringing to justice the men responsible for the 1972 Munich massacre of the Israeli Olympic athletes. And as I said, this movie and this character isn't really interested at all in any kind of self-gratification beyond just doing the job
and ultimately,
seeing it through.
I think that's what bothers me
really?
About this film.
Okay, that's what I like about it.
Is his earnestness. This guy's not going to be deterred at all.
Well, that's true, but I think then in the end it pays off because the real sad irony of the movie is that he's done all these really terrible things for his country and lost a lot. And by the end, because of those acts, he really has to be exiled from the place he loves, the place that is the reason why he did all those things. I think the movie does pay off in the end. Munich is my number three pick.
My number two. All right. This is one of my favorite films of the 1990s, and it's Outside Providence, directed by Michael Corrente, who attended the Trinity Rep Acting Conservatory in Providence, Rhode Island, which, of course, is now part of the Brown University Master's Program. And still,
who cares?
And still churns out great artistic minds to this very
doing
day.
Doing things like Massacre Theater
yeah,
on
exactly.
movie podcasts.
Yeah. Well, this movie, it's based on the novel by Peter Farrelly, and if only the Farrelly brothers had followed the formula for success found in this film. It's just a terrific, unsentimental coming-of-age film, and yes, it has the Farrelly gags. There's a three-legged dog, Alec Baldwin, in his best performance of the 90s, and that includes Glengarry.
Oh, plays, now, come on.
I swear to God, you got to watch it. As a blue-collar father who calls his son Dildo. And so, yeah, they're wacky. Those are wacky things.
Mm-hmm.
But they're woven into the script here, and they don't become a distraction. This is just a terrific film, Outside
I know
Providence.
A lot of people who do appreciate that movie a lot. I should break down and watch it at some point, but yeah. I have been on this anti-Farrelly kick lately.
It's not. Now it's
I
not
know.
Directed.
I
or,
know.
All right.
Okay.
Fine.
My number two, another movie from earlier this year, and it's David Fincher's film Zodiac. Begins in 1969, goes through to the early 90s, but the bulk of it takes place primarily in the 70s, of course. And Jake Gyllenhaal as Robert Graysmith loses his job. This, again, this obsessive quest idea becomes estranged from his wife and kids because of his obsession with finding the real identity of the Zodiac Killer. And Robert Downey Jr. is this journalist who descends into drug abuse. Mark Ruffalo is a detective who ends up getting demoted and really losing kind of his faith and everything that he believed in. And Fincher gets every little period detail right here. And I also like it because it references 70s cinema quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Bullet comes up, and also Dirty Harry, of course, which made their own version of the Zodiac Killer. And Fincher's really interested in that and seeing how the characters respond to that. I think he makes an interesting commentary on the nature of cop films by referencing that movie in there. So Zodiac is my number two.
Wow. Well, based on your criterion, I mean, those are three characters that are destroyed
You're right.
by their obsession.
Exactly.
I cannot wait for your number one.
Okay.
It's going to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
My number one is kind of boring because I've talked about this movie before, and that's The Ice Storm. And for me, this movie is almost a perfect film. And really what Ang Lee does so well here is its specificity. Yeah, these characters could exist in any decade, but he gets the 1970s so right. I just love this film.
I knew it would be your number one pick,
yeah.
And deservedly so. Not on my list, though, and you said you were curious to know what my number one pick is. You're going to hate my number one pick. It is...
Adam, you can't choose Network.
No.
Network does not qualify.
No,
you cannot squeeze it in
there. It's in the penalty box, and it was made in the 70s, so it can't count, unfortunately.
Oh, wait, I know what it is.
You know it's...
I know what it is.
The Last King of Scotland, James McAvoy.
God.
As a Scottish doctor fresh out of med school, he has a sort of hedonistic view like you'd expect a young man in his 20s to have. He doesn't want to just settle down and have a boring life like his parents. Wants to do something adventurous, but he's also an idealist. He thinks he can use his knowledge and his passion for good, and he ends up as Idi Amin's physician and advisor in Uganda. And to say that his little quest, Maddie, ends badly would obviously be an understatement. He certainly doesn't bring about any kind of good or positive change that he wanted to, but I do love McAvoy and Forrest Whitaker as Idi Amin, and the movie as a morality tale,
oh, yeah.
I think is brilliant.
Great. Just a great morality
it
tale.
It is, watching a character be brought down by his hubris and arrogance despite having good intentions. It's the essence of tragedy.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell you that, Mr. Brown's student.
Idi Amin's reign as a plot device for Escape from Uganda, starring James McAvoy.
Did Sam just invade your body and actually come into the room somehow
I'm sorry.
Here?
That's just a terrible film.
Okay. It's a great film, and it's my number one. I'm sorry that you disapprove, Maddie.
All right. Well, please do write in and tell us how bad our choices are, especially Adam's. Those are our top five Me Decade movies. Send your list or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
Opening wide this weekend, American Gangster, which we are both lukewarm on, fair to say, disappointed with that film. B-Movie, the Jerry Seinfeld animated film, and Martian Child with John Cusack. expanding this weekend, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
That's Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet's new film, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke in that movie, one we missed at the Chicago Film Festival. Look forward to checking that out. And on next week's show, our plan right now, it's our Coen Brothers blowout. We'll discuss No Country for Old Men, have an interview with No Country star Josh Brolin, and share, right now, we're thinking our top five Coen Brothers moments.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good one.
I think it would be good, but certainly if you have any other suggestions or any other ideas on how that segment should play out, please feel free to share those thoughts, feedback@filmspotting.net. And we also want you to note that Robert Redford's new political drama, Lions for Lambs, opens on the 9th next Friday as well, but we weren't able to get to an advanced screening of that film, so we'll have to put that review off a week.
All right. Thanks to Alex and Angela on our message boards, Frank Huckle and the great Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Johnny Society for this week's music. Learn more at messengerrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
To find it run over with the plague and begins, of course.
The plague?
To find it run over with the plague and begins.
What? What are you saying?
The plague.
The plague?
I say plague.
Since when?
I don't know. I've always said plague.
It's the plague. The black plague.
The black plague?
Yeah.
Plague?
Plague. I assure you.
Plague.
No.
Plague.
It's plague.
You know what it is?
What?
It's for 3 years, they've tried to get me, you know, in graduate school, They tried to get me to get rid of my Minnesota A.
Okay.
So I think I'm just overcompensating.
That's got to be it. It's definitely plague.
The plague.
Yeah.
See, that's what it is.
That sounds Midwestern. And,
yeah.
But that's what it is.
Oh, my God. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. It's just totally,
right,
it's like Mommy Dearest. Like, my God.
Uh-huh.
Oh, no more wire hangers.
That is totally what it is.
All right.